Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Coverage of the corn production area in drought for the U.S. is just 19%, down 5 points from the beginning of the month. Pretty much the same with soybeans, 17% drought coverage, also 5 points from the beginning of the month. And then as we shift to the south, good news for the cotton belt at this time, just 8% of the U.S. cotton belt in drought at the end of April. No change from the beginning of the month.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Our current number for the U.S. hay production area in drought is just 12% at the end of April. That's down 2 points from the beginning of April and also down from last autumn's peak of 42% of the hay production area in drought. Very similar picture with cattle, just 17% of the U.S. cattle inventory in drought at the end of April, up slightly from early April, 13%, but way down from last fall when we saw 47% of the U.S. cattle inventory in drought.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Yeah, this FEPA organization is remarkable. It's kind of the top crop insurance agents from around the land, from every corner of our nation.
Tom Sell is co-founder and manager of Combest Sell and Associates.
I guess a couple things really stood out to me. One, just their reflections on kind of the current state of the economy and the challenges that their producers are facing. You know, even this year, the crop insurance price elections, the amount that you can cover is significantly less than it was last year. For corn producers, it's about 20% less. It's all based on the market and the market prices. But certainly the kind of palpable feel around that room, and we had many, you know, kind of government officials there, the chief economist of the USDA, our main administrator, representatives from Congress. The palpable feel around that room was, man, we need to get this done. If there is any way possible, the ag economy, the producers who put so much at risk every year, they need tools at their fingertips to make sure they can go year to year. And there's a lot of stress in the countryside. So that was the one big takeaway. But then also, you know, I think in this farm bill, crop insurance is going to be, a big part. Again, the members of Congress who were there were saying, you know, when you contrast ad hoc assistance, which is always kind of poorly measured and way late, you know, relative to when the disaster occurs, it's such a contrast to the very reliable, known, you know, bankable products that we know in crop insurance. And so I think members of Congress, and certainly I think sentiment from the countryside is, look, if we're going to get rid of ad hoc disasters, that's great, but put it into something that's very reliable. And I think crop insurance is that horse that Congress is going to look to improve the outlook for producers.
And the fact that agriculture remains such a top priority for members of Congress is no accident.
I'd say that's been kind of my work for the last, you know, 25 years, trying to build an appreciation for all that agriculture does for our you know, individual lives, but also for our economy, for the culture of our great nation, kind of this entrepreneurial spirit that farmers bring to the table every day. So I think there is a bedrock appreciation. And you get to issues like trade or energy, where ag has always been a big part of our national trade, our international trade profile. Increasingly, it's becoming more of a part of the conversation in the energy sector as well. You know, it's always been that to an extent. You know, food is the most basic form of energy, providing that kind of caloric content that we all need to be creative and think of great things. So it is a very natural part of all the conversation. There's always been some level of misunderstanding about the role that federal policies play in it, and that's been our job, is to just try and help the members of Congress, the representatives in government, just understand all that goes into you know, getting from a seed to a marketable product internationally, and some of it builds back into the economies of local towns like Florida, Texas, or wherever you are. And that this story of ag is remarkable. It is truly one of the great heroes of our economy and our culture. All that it does to just build communities throughout the heartland of the U.S. that have truly made this nation great. So, yeah, you just asked me kind of a bread and butter question, but. I do think, to answer your question plainly, I think there is a greater appreciation for all that agriculture does today than there was 20, 25 years ago. I think we have a great, strong basis of support to get this farm bill done. The last farm bill passed at the end in the conference report with more than 84% affirmative votes in both the House and the Senate. And I think if done right, you know, following a lead and working with G.T. Thompson and Debbie Stabenow, we can exceed those margins this year.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
A party that's basically, let's say, just an American party that's all about country first, and it's all about center left, center right. The grand old party be grand again, Democrat party be responsible again, and those people really feel like they're homeless right now because you're shoved to one side or the other.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin recently at the Milken Institute's 2024 Global Conference.
Is there a place? I think having a place like that, you're going to bring both the D and the R duopoly of the businesses that they formed back to a realization this is not what we're there for. It's not all about how much money we have coming in, how big is our operation, this and that, and the other side's the enemy. The other side just has a different opinion how to fix something. That's how we should. I've never looked at, you know, I've been in politics for a long time. And when Harry Reid told me in 2011, in January 2011, he said, Joe, we're going to have a party line vote. Now, I've been Secretary of State. I've been in the House and I've been in State Senate. And I've been a governor in my state. I never heard the term party line vote. I said, Harry, what's that mean? We all got to vote for this. I said, we do. I said, what do you mean? I said, let me read the bill. And I read the bill and I said, Harry, on my best day, I can't sell this crap. In West Virginia, it makes no sense. I can't go home. He says, he started explaining to me why I should. I said, Harry, you're not my boss. I don't work for you. You can't hire me. You didn't hire me. And you can't fire me. Well, you can imagine our relationship went downhill after that. And that's what's expected because that's the model. That was his business model. And once I start realizing it, my daughter, Heather, brought that to my attention, the business duopoly that we're all part of, and sometimes we don't realize the grip they have on us. She realizes it because when she went from the D to the I, you saw all the things change. And that's when it comes to reality, what's happening to you. We've got to change that. And I think a third party is needed more today than ever before to keep the two from going off the rails.
Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford.
I don't think you can have 10 parties and say that suddenly solves it. You have to have integrity in the process on it as well. People have got to be able to engage, and they need to be able to vote on it. I look at so many countries around the world that have a parliament, and they'll have 10, 11, 12 parties on it and say that works really, really smooth. But actually, that coalition is chaotic as well. And now you just have the chaotic coalitions that are actually have to be formed to be able to get anything done. At the end of the day, you have to determine whether you're going to really get stuff done, and you've got to actually stop attacking people that you disagree with sometimes, but also agree with sometimes. That fellow American is not my enemy. That fellow American, right. We disagree on things, but we disagree on things. Okay, well, let's figure it out like grown-ups do on this.
And why so much fighting?
Years ago, if any of you know the author, his name is Max Lucado. He's from San Antonio. He's a pastor in the area, and he tells a story about going fishing with some friends, and they rent an RV. They go out to a fishing place. They get there, and it's pouring down rain. So they just play card games all day. The next day they get up to go fishing again, it's pouring down on rain, so they're playing card games in their little RV, but they're kind of nipping at each other. By the third day, they're fighting so much, they just pick up their RV and drive home. And he said, the lesson that I learned from that was when fishermen don't fish, they fight. We're at that moment now legislatively. When we don't legislate, we just fight. When we're not trying to accomplish something, when we're not doing what we're there to do, right. It's a lot easier to be able to fight and do a press conference. There's all these different outside special interest groups in Washington, D.C. that they make all their money off of attacking the other side and, quite frankly, attacking their own. Mm-hmm. Fundraising in D.C. is a lot easier when you're a Republican group if you're attacking fellow Republicans. That's easy money to raise. Those folks aren't pure enough. So they raise tons of money on that, and it just causes the fight. When fishermen don't fish, they fight. Is very true in D.C. When people aren't legislating, when they're not sitting down and working together to try to solve stuff together, it's just a lot easier, and quite frankly, in campaign dollars, better to be able to fight than it is to be able to actually fish.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
It is looking fantastic.
Patrick Wade is policy director with the Texas Grain Sorghum Producers. On the season's first sorghum crop.
We've got staff down there on the Gulf Coast this week for some meetings and moving down into South Texas. And there is really a lot of excitement this year. The rain has been timely. They started off wet just around planting season, and they got to plant into some moisture. And we've seen that momentum really carry through this growing season. You know, we're maybe a month, maybe a little bit more than a month out from really seeing harvest pick up. And there's just a lot of anticipation for the first time in a couple of years, you know, a really tremendous crop down there. We've come close to it before, and certainly last year, you know, we saw a good South Texas and Gulf Coastal crop kind of rescue what had been a really challenging year for the sorghum industry, especially here in Texas. But right now, like, there's a lot of optimism that we're going to see a real bumper crop this year down there.
Obviously, China's a big buyer, but how do we get sorghum to those end users in China?
Yeah, Tony, that's a great question. And one, I know that certainly a lot of the commodity trade in general has been really working on hard this year, as those logistics are really critical to making all these prices work out. Look, one thing, of course, that we take a lot of pride in Texas is, as you referenced, the port terminals that we have in Texas up and down the Gulf Coast have seen 80 to 85% of the entire bulk load of U.S. sorghum to China since China started buying now over 10 years ago, have been going out of those terminals, loaded up there at the Texas Gulf Coast and gone around, yes, either through Panama or further around South America, and up through those trade channels there. We hope to see, you know, a bit of an expansion, a bit of an uptick, in the availability of the Panama Canal, especially one that would correspond this summer with our ability to get this first sorghum crop in South Texas and the Gulf Coast out and over to China. But, you know, we see the rippling effects, of logistics and freight and ship availability, ripple through, all the trade. For sorghum, look, it's a bulk load, 32,000, 55,000, metric ton vessels, that are loaded up. You don't see it really containerized or receive any other kind of specialized treatment like that. It's pretty easy to load bulk freight sorghum and get it out. But regardless of the availability of those ships, and whether it's challenges, across the world in the Red Sea or, limitations, due to drafting in the Panama Canal, these things all ripple through and certainly, come down to affect us as well.
What do farmers need to stay focused on?
I think it's important for everyone to keep up with the conversation around sustainability and conservation and look for ways you can continue to improve efficiencies in your operation, particularly if you're someone who raises grain sorghum in your rotation. Whether it's national sorghum producers receiving a Climate Smart Commodities grant or some of the work we're doing in Texas to promote water and conservation efficiency with some of our partners, there's a lot of opportunities coming down the road for growers who really embrace being at the front of a lot of these changes and willing to see that there are a lot of real concrete market opportunities that are going to be developed if you're able to prove demonstrably that, in your operation, you are improving water efficiency, improving soil health, improving resiliency. These are all stories to tell that we've been telling from a sort of qualitative level over the years. But as the funding and the technical assistance comes in to quantify, I think there's a lot of opportunities for partnership there to put U.S. sorghum on a pedestal and show that around the world, this is a commodity, a crop that represents, a real resource conserving option, and to find market benefits for that, too. There's a lot of great work being done there.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We do see them year round. In fact, last year, because we were still kind of dealing with the hangover of the supply chain challenges, we saw a lot of spring delivery of combines.
Kurt Blades is with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
In general, I'll tell you what, the combine market's really exciting. First of all, that's a considered purchase. It's a $500,000 plus piece of equipment. And there's new technology just abound in that industry. So you're seeing a lot of demand that's being driven by technology and farmers wanting to take the most advantage of that they possibly can. So that's an exciting market. Even though we're seeing a little bit of softness in the month of March, I'm really optimistic about the combine market, for the next, 18, 24 months.
Blades talks about disruptions to logistics, especially in the wake of the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse in Baltimore.
Anytime there is a disruption in logistics, there's a ripple effect. And even if it wasn't an important market for equipment, which it is, but even if it wasn't, we would still be feeling some ripple effects. What I've been able to hear from our members and really what farmers have been able to see is that, we're a pretty resilient market. We responded quickly. And obviously we want that port to get open as quick as it possibly can. It was last week in Washington, D.C., and we were hearing some indications that, that progress is coming along quickly. But we also know that this is a really important time for farmers. So our manufacturers responded pretty quickly and, moved some of that volume to Savannah right away and moved equipment into areas so it wouldn't have minimal disruption on that important planting season. So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that's happening below the surface. But I think overall, those of us on the consuming side, very little effects on that. But obviously, anytime there's a jolt in logistics, it's a challenge. And we want, you know, hearts go out, you know, to those that lost their lives during that tragedy. But also, I think, you know, it just points to how resilient, the manufacturing sector is in responding to challenges and figure out ways to make the disruption as minimal as possible.
And talks about his excitement of returning to the National Mall.
I am so excited to be having our second celebration of modern agriculture on the National Mall. That's the first week of May 6, 7, 8. Well, we're going to have probably 40 different pieces of modern farm equipment and a number of trade associations as well, telling that story of modern agriculture to legislators, policymakers, the general public, really anyone that's willing to listen, to tell that story of how this equipment's pretty fun and makes a big difference. What is amazing when you speak with people from, you know, say EPA or even USDA and OSHA that have not seen modern farm equipment or maybe haven't been on a farm in 5 to 10 years, and you see their eyes light up when they see firsthand what's going on with the technology and what we're able to do with sensors and optical sensors, and it is a fun story to tell. So we're looking forward to doing that with the whole ag industry here in a couple of weeks. And, you know, I'd ask all of your listeners, if they happen to be in the D.C. area that week, come by and see us. Or even better, tell your elected officials to come see us on the National Mall so they can do a better job of communicating to their peers that aren't as familiar with the ag market as we approach this important farm bill season.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It was just 10 people getting together and then announcing to the world, like Venus de Milo coming up on the beach, hey, we're here, we're beautiful, and look at our policy. It won't be nearly as attractive as Venus de Milo.
Dr. Bill Cassidy is a Republican senator from Louisiana.
If it is 10 people who really put the time in, who accept disappointment, but they don't quit, then they begin to socialize, right, the so-called Overton window. What is an acceptable discourse? And they begin to socialize it. You've got to have a two-chamber strategy, too. So you've got to be working the House side on a bipartisan basis. You've got to be working the White House because they can veto you. And you've got to be working your leadership so that they understand, you know, they're not blindsided. Now, and you've got to be working your stakeholders. I'm working on Social Security. We just made, for a while, and I have three of those partners, one, two, and three. We had 14 senators ready to go out and announce we had a plan, and the White House deep-sixed it. Okay, well, we brush ourselves off. We're trying to get ready for next year. But we are speaking to AARP, to Heritage Foundation, to NAACP, to Committee for for a Responsible Federal Budget. You can do that. If the 10 are willing to do the hard work that Lankford speaks of, to touch every one of those boxes and a few more that I didn't.
Right.
And still you might not succeed, but if you win, you really win.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin.
The thing that, if you're asking, probably we all agree on this, the current thing that we're concerned about most in our country is the misinformation that changes the culture. And I think what Kirsten said is absolutely correct. Where is the crux of the problem? Guys, we're just moving into AI in its infancy. Can you imagine what that's going to do? If you think you've got misinformation now, people having doubt, they don't trust us, that rule of law is not really the rule of law, or orderly transfer of power really is not a fair election, someone stole it, and on and on and on and on. What we're going to be getting into, I mean, we've already gone through some of that. But, you know, the Constitution says trying to form and putting the Constitution together a more perfect union. There's no perfect bill. I've never voted on a bill that says, man, that was perfect. I've never seen one. We try, but it's not there. And no is the easiest vote we make. No. And when I vote no, I don't have to explain a lot. Because there's always people who says, I didn't like that. And I could always defend it by saying, it just didn't fix this. That's why I wasn't for it.
Right.
So we've used the analogy of this. I talk to people, I says, let me ask you, when you go to a football game, do you get up and leave at first quarter when they don't score a touchdown every time? You okay with a couple of first downs, maybe, you know? Do you basically get up and leave a basketball game because they don't make 3 points every time they shoot? you know, foul shots will sometimes win a game. I keep trying to put it in perspective. That's not who we are. So why do you expect us to have a perfect bill? Why is this, Christian, how come it just wasn't this? You left this out. I can't vote for you for that. It's crazy. It's so what happens is, in order to protect themselves, if it's institutionalized, just vote no.
Yep.
Just continue to vote no, because I can guarantee you, they won't push you too far, because they'll find, you're right, I didn't know that was in there.
At the end of the day, Republican Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma remains optimistic.
We've been through hard times before as a country. You can look back through 60 years ago. Everything in the northern part of the United States used to be Republican, and everything in the southern part of the United States used to be Democrat, and that has switched in many ways. So you watch the culture. We still have a functioning constitution. We're still protecting that constitution. That guideline is still there, and it makes a big difference.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We don't always like to talk about industry trends, if that makes sense, when we know more about our products than most other people do.
Kara Bishop is with Plains Cotton Growers.
But when it comes to educating consumers, the sustainability of our product is a competitive advantage that we need to be shouting from the rooftops. There are so many advantages to using cotton and wearing cotton for our ecosystems and our environment compared to polyester, which harms the environment. We know it does. We have research to prove that. We have research to prove that cotton will biodegrade and that polyester will not. These are things that our customers and our consumers and our people in society need to know. And I'll be real honest with you. I have lived in cotton country my entire life, and I've never really checked labels on things like socks, because I just assumed most of the socks are made of cotton. And I wrote about this for Earth Day a couple of weeks ago, because I went to Walmart and I just looked at all the socks in the women's sock aisle. And there was only one type of sock that was predominantly cotton, and it wasn't 100%. Because I had a farmer tell me that he couldn't find 100% cotton socks. And I didn't quite believe that, because I just assumed they were cotton, because we assume a lot. And don't assume that the people next to you, the people that don't farm or the people that may live in your farming community know, because they may not. I didn't. And we need to be talking to all of our friends, regardless of whether we assume they know or not. And we need to be talking to other people outside of our circles, because this is important, that cotton be affordable options of cotton be in stores for society to take advantage of. And I'm going to tell you why, and I know this is a long-winded answer, but I am getting to the point. Cotton Incorporated had some facts about plastic, and I just want to kind of read these. 14 million metric tons of plastic are released into the oceans every year. Every time clothes are washed, microfibers enter our waterways. Both polyester and cotton microfibers enter our waterways. These fibers are too small to be completely filtered by wastewater treatment equipment. The cotton microfibers break down in water in just over 3 months, which is a rate similar to oak leaves, because it's a natural fiber. We know that. However, synthetic fibers take for anywhere from 20 to 200 years to break down in the same environment. Fibers from synthetic clothing make up 35% of the microplastics in our oceans. By 2050, there may be more plastic in our oceans than fish. 81% of tested water samples from major metro areas around the world were contaminated with plastic fibers. This microplastic waste affects everything in the ecosystem, including what we eat, and the average person consumes approximately a credit card worth of plastic every week. And I just think it's amazing that this is bona fide research that we need to be telling everyone, because not only is cotton better for our ecosystems and environment, but it's better for our health as individuals. We have a society that is now very in tune to its own wellness and its own, you know, you get a lot of people who want to eat organic, which is a whole other argument, but people are in tune to what's best for them and what's better for them. And cotton has proved that it's better for them, but we need to be talking about it. And I feel like sometimes, from my perspective, I assume that people know things that they don't know. And as someone who wasn't from cotton farming background, someone who just lived in rural agriculture, my dad had a cow-calf operation, you know, I didn't know these things.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The United Nations General Assembly has passed a resolution declaring the year 2026 as the International Year of the Woman Farmer. U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield told reporters about half the world's food, and in some countries 80%, is produced by women farmers.
And they farm with less financial backing, less technology, less education, less cultural and governmental support than their male counterparts.
And so U.S. Deputy Agriculture Secretary Xochitl Torres-Small said this U.N. resolution will explore
different ways to support women farmers, whether that's land ownership, whether that's tech transfer and how we can use agrotech to support women farmers, or whether that's support through technical assistance, right? How can we enable mentorship that creates more opportunities?
And Linda Thomas-Greenfield said in the fight against global food insecurity,
we have a powerful tool, and that is women farmers.
This is Gary Crawford, Washington.